Okay, great. I'm not going to use PowerPoint for this presentation. I'm actually going to spend the first few minutes telling you a story about one person who I interviewed in a recent project. As I tell you this story, I want to ask you to sort of keep in mind two of the questions that I'm trying to address based on my recent project, which I hope this story illustrates. And one is, how can critical realism contribute to a better understanding of the complexity involved in people dealing with serious mental health issues? That's one. That was sort of the crust of this paper. But as I was writing the paper, I increasingly faced sort of a larger meta-theoretical question about the absence of any meaningful discussion about ongoing vulnerability as part of the human condition. And this made me question my own assumptions and the own types of things I was trying to explain. So those are the two things I want you to keep in mind. How can critical realism help us understand complex issues of causality around issues of mental health, and how do we deal better in the social sciences with human vulnerability? But let me get you thinking by telling you about a woman I met as part of my recent project, who I call Laura. Laura was bullied for being obese as a child. She became pregnant when she was 15, dropped out of high school, and began living with the father of her child. She described to me that her child brought her happiness that she had never experienced in her life. Until one day, she got a call to come home from her job as a receptionist at a pharmacy because her little baby had gotten out of the back door and drowned in a pond in her backyard. The baby was not dead when she arrived, so she went with the paramedics to the hospital. And she was praying incessantly to God to save her baby's life, even if her baby would have been brain damaged. She described the darkness that she experienced, and it really made me shiver. She said, "I felt like I was in the dark, like there's no light at the end of the tunnel. How could God have abandoned me?" After her child's death, Laura's mother, her father, the child's father all experienced great anguish and guilt over the child's death. They were all at home that day. She was the only one who was not there. So these already fragile relationships she had in her family splintered even more. And particularly, the child's father began to abuse drugs and alcohol. But Laura wouldn't give up on the relationship. In fact, they had another child together. They were then separated for some time, during which time she had a child with somebody else, but then got back together with the father of her first two children. And as she told me this story, I actually scribbled in my notes, "She's not all there." And I wasn't entirely sure what I was observing, but her eyes were sort of glassed over, and she had a hard time standing straight, even holding herself up in this chair in front of me in a coffee shop. She told me that she had been prescribed, she was currently taking four different kinds of mental health medications. Prior to that, she had tried to self-medicate her grief through smoking marijuana about three times a day until she was arrested for marijuana possession, put into supervision, and told she had to get off marijuana and take these medications instead for her symptoms. And it was also interesting to me that Laura, despite what a terrible state she was in, really wanted to tell me about the hope she had for her children, and that what kept her going was her belief that she could give her children a good life. She managed to get up and go to work every day. The father of her child still lived with her, although he abused her physically, emotionally, and even sexually. But she wanted to give her children something better. When I went back to re-interview her about a year and a half later, I had no idea what I was going to find. I kept thinking, is she going to get past this finish line of her pain, she called it. "Will there ever be a finish line to my pain?" she said. And I wondered what she would be like a year and a half. She walked into the same coffee shop, and I hardly recognized her. She was actually holding herself upright. She was looking around, making eye contact, and had a little bit of a smile on her face. She sat down and we began to talk, and I said, so, you know, how's it been going? Well, it turns out that her drug counselor also became sort of an advocate for her to evict her boyfriend from her house, which actually took a police order because he was living with her and he wouldn't voluntarily leave. And once that change happened, she felt a whole lot better emotionally and simply stopped going to the doctor and stopped taking all those medications. And she just said, you know, the words she used really got to me. She said, I felt numb. I felt like a zombie. I felt like a rat. She was taking 4 medications when I met her, but she had tried something like 12 different ones. If this one doesn't work, try this one, then try this one, try that one. And she just said, okay, that's it. I'm done. And I said, so do you now smoke marijuana again? And she admitted that she does, but not as much. And, you know, so I'm listening to her tell me this. And she described her medications as blocking all the bad stuff. But the problem was that she didn't feel anything at all. As she said, you don't feel no care. And it was also interesting in the interaction of the interview, she wanted to know if I could empathize with her. So she said, you know, do you know, like, have you ever felt that way? Like, you don't have no care? And I said, well, I tried to come up with something. And I was like, well, you know, when my father died, you know, I cried so much that at some point I wasn't crying anymore, but I was just kind of, yeah, I guess I was just kind of numb. She's like, that's how I felt on medication all the time. And I said, okay. But when I talk, so when I came away from this, and this type of narrative, I mean, I won't go into some of the other stories I heard, though I put some of them in the paper and I have many more. I actually kept hearing very similar stories. I met Laura through the contact information. She was a participant in the National Study of Youth and Religion, and I had this kind of brilliant idea 4 years ago that it would be really fun to go out and conduct in-person interviews with respondents from a national survey who varied on all kinds of characteristics. And typically people who do these wonderfully nationally representative surveys won't let you go contact their people. But I had coffee with Chris Smith and I pitched this idea to him and he said, yeah, I think we can make that work. And lo and behold, it was great. I was able to analyze the National Study of Youth and Religion. I basically picked people who said they had experienced some kind of trauma, though the question didn't specify what that was, and that was actually fine from my point of view. And I got the contact information, and I said, you've been in the National Study of Youth and Religion, I'm going to be in your town, can I come chat with you? And actually, they all said yes. I think one person I didn't hear back from, they all said yes. So Laura was one of these 26 people. But I was so struck by her experience that I wanted to go back and re-interview her, and I went back to everybody because I wanted to see what would change over time. But in these interviews, it was astounding to me that everybody who had been on mental health medication for any reason at all described very similar experiences as Laura. They actually used the word numb. Now, when I wrote my first questionnaire, it didn't have any questions at all about mental health medication, right? So it was kind of like reality is punching me in the face when there's something happening and people are using the same language to describe something that I don't even ask about. Something's going on. And in the meantime, between the interviews, I read the different accounts of what at least sociology has to say about this phenomenon. And I go into this a bit in the paper that on the one hand, I think what I was hearing in my narratives is somewhat of a critique of the mechanistic view of the body, which may not be what any doctor would tell you they're doing, but if you think about how people think about medicine, you've got one problem in your brain, and if you apply this medication, that problem's going to go away. It's decontextualized. It's decontextualized from their social context, it's decontextualized from their relationships, it's decontextualized from history. If we can just identify the right mechanism, we can treat it. Right? That's one point of view. Then there's this whole medical sociology literature that tries to show all of the social influences on what gets defined as mental illness, about how it gets diagnosed, about the role of medical authority in treating, etc. But to me, that literature stops short of really, that literature ends up leaving the reader thinking, well, there's nothing biological at all about mental illness then. It's just a social, it's just yet another social construction and another category that we create. And some of the literature explicitly says that, some of it implicitly says that. that there's nothing to mental illness. It's a social category. But in listening to somebody like Laura, she never actually denied that she had mental illness and that it had a biological element. So does that mean with a better diagnosis and a better treatment, she would have been better? If we just get the biology right, we'll fix it? I'm not sure. So then the sort of third perspective, and this is actually a perspective I was drawn to, was, oh, wait a minute, you know, there's actually something redeeming about trauma. You know, people can grow a lot. They can grow from adversity. So one of the sort of reactions to the medicalization of trauma is to say, hey, look, not everybody who experiences trauma suffers. You can grow from it. So there's this whole positive psychology literature, resilience literature, which I was very initially drawn to. But in my earlier presentations of Laura and others, I kept getting pushed on this question of human vulnerability. And people would tell me, it sounds like you're saying, you know, if Laura or everybody else just tried hard enough, they could find that meaning, they could find that growth, and, you know, that bad thing that happened to them would just be gone, right? And so as I went back and reread my literature and went back and talked to Laura, I had these questions in my mind. And so what I've tried to do a little bit in this paper is argue for something of what I was saying in my earlier presentation, that I think critical realism's account of causality gives a better way of understanding what's happening with Laura. To the extent that whatever the biological basis of a mental disorder could be, it's always got to be understood in a particular person's life as interacting with their social context and interacting with their relationships, and not to mention interacting with actual events that happen, right? So I think critical realism provides a language to describe what's going on in terms of understanding Laura's situation. That doesn't necessarily lead us to say a lot of the critiques of the biological view of mental illness, I think, still are relying on kind of a covering law model of causality, right? If such and such doesn't always cause mental illness, then it's not a cause. I've seen this again and again. In fact, I saw it in a paper one of my students gave me from a class on drugs. Did you know that drugs are not addictive? Because not everybody who tries them gets addicted. Therefore, drugs don't cause addiction. This was in a very, very respectable brain science journal. And so to me, these are serious scientists. This is not, you know, Fox News, right? This is serious scientists saying, we've made this argument that drugs cause addiction. And look, drugs don't always cause addiction, so we can say they're not a cause of addiction. And to me, that's like, wait a minute, whoa, whoa, whoa. They're relying on this implicit covering law model. So, and I also dealt with cases of addiction in my study as well. So I think critical realism offers a way to say that even if drugs don't always cause addiction, that doesn't mean that they're not a cause. It means that they're interacting with other causes, and there could be countervailing causes. But I also can't see how you have addiction to a drug without using the drug. So there are people out there who want to discard the biological basis of mental health and addiction because it doesn't correspond to a covering law model. Therefore, it's not a cause. And we should be looking elsewhere for causes, right? We should look at the social structure. We should look at culture. And I think critical realism would say, well, no. I mean, we can know if there's a biological basis to these things, but how the cause operates will interact with social and cultural, et cetera. So that's kind of one point about causality. And I think then sort of a second point about my method is that in actually sitting down and having people tell their stories, I've been accused of essentially reading tarot cards, you know. I will get that person in the room who just says, you know, you just told me something based on interviews. Oh, come on. You know, we know people just lie in interviews. I'm like, really? People just flat out lie all the time about everything in an interview? So I've actually had to defend myself from this critique numerous times. And I've done that partially in this paper and a couple of drafts of other papers. And I've tried to argue that, well, if there's going to be any person's life story is going to have elements of it It's not that every life story should be taken as kind of a factual representation of everything that's ever happened, right? What are we doing when we're thinking about how people tell their life stories? There's going to be some events that get left out. There's going to be some events that actually get reinterpreted over time, even in the course of a single interview, much less over time, right? But again, because how people narrate their lives changes within a single interview or across time, that makes people really uncomfortable, you know? If they change their mind about something, then that means they were lying, not necessarily. So I think sociology in particular needs to understand narrative analysis for its ability to tie together events with meaning, right? I just don't see how you get meaning, not at a personal level, from a survey. There have been attempts to say, well, interviews reveal meanings, and then we can write really good questions about meaning and put them on a survey, and that'll really tell us meaning. But that's a very momentary way of understanding meaning, right? So narratives let us see the kind of the connection of events and meaning across time, including the future, right? So that's one really important thing that interviews can do. I don't have time to go into it here, but there are, of course, there are things about Laura's narrative about which I doubt. For example, she believes her boyfriend is possessed by evil spirits. In theory, that's possible. I may not be able to tell from this interview, but she also, you know, was on marijuana when she says that, or maybe doing other things. So, you know, who knows? So it's not that I'm not critical of some things that she's saying, but when we're approaching interviews, I think we have to start from the presupposition that there must be something true. A narrative can't just be any social construction you want it to be. A person can't tell their life story. Laura couldn't tell the life story of James, et cetera, because she doesn't have dyslexia, she doesn't have these other things. So this idea that people can say whatever they want in an interview, to me seems to be a very, very weak assertion. Which doesn't mean you're not critical of it, and again, I think critical realism would say that all methods potentially are fallible, and the interview reveals things that we would have to use our judgment to decide if they're true or not, but you can't just throw them out. So understanding narrative as a way, and I think Doug Porpora has explained this very well in his book, narrative as a way of understanding the complexity and the contingency and the conjunctural nature of causality. And I think interviews are a very good way to do that. And then finally, and I'll sort of end here, that I've really struggled, perhaps because, as I said in my earlier presentation, that I was still trained in research methods, that what you do when you do interviews is, you know, you code and you come up with categories and you compare and you compare cases and you come up with charts. You know, this many people said this and this many people said that, right? And so what I initially wanted to do with these interviews was kind of figure out who's more resilient, right? Who's been able to overcome. And when I went back and did the second round of interviews, I realized that that really wasn't, if you listen to what people are saying, they're not categorizing themselves as resilient or vulnerable. And in fact, some of the people I talked to had suffered severe traumas and gone on to do amazing things. And it was tempting to say, look, these people are resilient. But if you listen to their own narratives, what I kept hearing again and again was that people who had experienced a lot of trauma, whether they had achieved good income or education or whatever, had been transformed in their understanding of themselves and understood their fragility and their vulnerability to be something that was never going to be completely eradicated. And I began to wonder, why does sociology treat human vulnerability as something we should prevent or eliminate or find some positive meaning in, right? And so I did a little bit of, you know, thinking and reading on that, and I'd love to discuss that more. But as I'm writing this up, I'm trying to argue that people are resilient and vulnerable at the same time. And that if the social sciences can't grapple with the fact that human vulnerability is part of what it is to be human, I mean, I think Alasdair MacIntyre in Dependent Rational Animals makes this point, and in some ways he's building further past what he said in After Virtue, that when we talk about virtue in the social science, it's usually the ones about rationality and justice and, you know, positive, growth-oriented ones, rather than what does a society look like that would actually account for the fragile, vulnerable, weak part of human nature, and that any of us at any moment could right now fall sick or have an illness or get into a car accident, which actually happened to me last week. And believe me, I felt very vulnerable and very fragile. And it can happen in an instant, right? So I think the social science explanations, and I'll end here, about mental health and addiction will never get to these larger issues that Laura wanted to talk about. What does it mean that I have pain that's never going to end? I cry every day about my baby still. What does that mean to me? Why did God abandon me? What is the purpose of my life? Even if we could eradicate her symptoms of mental illness, there was nothing in the literature that I looked at that actually gave a language to talk about the moral and existential and transcendental questions that people are asking. And so how do we bring those into sociology without going too far in the hermeneutic interpretivist direction and not talking about causes or social structures or all of that, right? So how do we recover an interpretive sociology that's also very much trying to address questions of causality? Okay.